Hey WTDers, Ryan here. The next few weeks are going to sound a little different than usual on the podcast. We had our first ever live event on Saturday, July 27th in Dallas, Texas. It was our first ever Dallas Series Live event. We had a great turnout, and we want to say thank you to everyone who came out to support us in person and to anybody who helped volunteer during that event. We could not have done it without y'all. The Dallas Series Live event consisted of four sessions total. Each of us presented at one of these sessions. After those three were finished, we did a Q&A panel where we really got to talk through a host of topics from reparations to gentrification to whiteness to capitalism. You know, it was kind of like one of our normal podcast episodes. What you're going to hear over the next several weeks are the live talks that each of us gave at the event. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you will have access to all three of these sessions, plus the additional Q&A panel discussion. If you want to check out the Q&A, consider signing up at patreon.com/wetalkdifferent. We're also posting more supplemental material over there as we go forward for our Patreon supporters. As always, thank you for listening and supporting us by leaving reviews, spreading the podcast to other listeners, inviting us to talk at your venue, or financially through patreon.com. So, without further mansplaining, hit that beautiful theme music. I just want to say thank y'all for coming out today. I honestly figured that when we did this, it was going to be me, E, and Ash talking to the volunteers that we brought, which would have been Jen and my wife Jocelyn and Cecily, whoever else come out. But I really thank y'all for coming out. This has been a really interesting journey for the last, Ash and I have been doing it for 6 years now together talking. But then publicly since 2016. So as the white guy in the group, I just want to say thank you all for coming out. I'm really happy to see all of the faces. I'm amazed at how the conversations we've had have resonated with people, not just in this city, but we've gotten letters and notes and reviews from people all across the country. So this is a much needed conversation. So, all right, let's jump in. Have you ever stopped to consider how language shapes our reality? What words mean, how they come to mean anything at all? Jon Snow, one of the primary characters on the Game of Thrones, if I have any Thrones fans, I know I have at least one, so you're in the middle, which is good. He said in a critical episode, when enough people make false promises, words stop meaning anything. Then there are no more answers. Only better and better lies. A show that followed that show, HBO's Chernobyl, I watch a lot of HBO if that's kind of the theme here. The main character on that show said, what is the cost of lies? It's not that we're going to mistake them for the truth. The real danger is that if we hear enough lies, we no longer recognize the truth at all. Yeah. What can we do then? One of my repeated tenets that I teach when I talk is that words matter. Language matters. How you say what you say matters. Author and professor, social activist Gloria Jean Watkins, better known under pen name as Bell Hooks, has said, language is also a struggle. Language matters because it defines your reality. It provides hooks to make explicit the things that are implicit inside of you. Language is the vehicle through which we identify and we disassociate. We encourage and we tear down. Words matter. Language matters. In a very real sense, I believe we are organized culturally around words. People are way over here, too. I didn't even notice that. Hey, good to see you. We are essentially logocentric. From this word centering, we construct meaning, and more specifically, we construct stories. As a result, I'm going to try to be careful about the words that I use to talk to you today, but even in my conception of that matters, that is in itself also a story. It's a story that I've come to understand by how I grew up, the family that I had, the schools I attended,
the spouse who now writes a story alongside of my own, the interplay between Ashley's story and Elijah's story and my own. This story that Words Matter has shaped my reality, I believe it's shaped yours too, but you may not have ever explicitly thought about the ways in which it does that. Today, I want to talk about what has become my main contention in life. And you've heard me, if you've heard me on the podcast, I've said this before. The story you tell yourself about yourself is the most important story you tell. These stories are the narratives of our lives. These stories, they make up our identities, what we tell ourselves we are and what we tell other people that we are. Motherhood is a story. Being a doctor is a story. Masculinity and toxic masculinity, those are stories. Racism is a story. Nationalism is a story. Republican, Democrat, Protestant, Catholic, evangelical, right? These are stories, ways that we frame the world. To be human, I believe, is to create meaning, trying to find order within the chaos of our lives. We experience things and then we do what? We supply meaning to it. We interpret. And in my understanding, that interpretive act, that is everything. That helps you tell your story. Your friend says something to you and you ask yourself, what did she mean by that? We read a text and ask, what does this mean? We are constantly supplying meaning, meaning to our actions and the actions of others, meaning to movies we watch and books that we read and music that we listen to. I've come to understand this search for meaning, this making sense of the world, primarily through the vehicle of story. One of the things that I think defines us as human is our ability to cultivate and communicate these stories. Because it's not just that I want to create that meaning, I want to actually share that with somebody else. Story is, I believe, how we impose order on our reality. So I tried to work in some comic books too, because I love comic books, but I couldn't really fit that in this talk, so that's why y'all are going to see a couple comic book backgrounds, so you know. So we seek to impose order on our world. Why? I think because, again, we're meaning makers. Being human means to attempt to understand the world beyond my own head. It is an attempt to make meaning and situate myself within a construction of reality. So let me give you an example. It was a bright and sunny day in Michigan, the kind where you feel like the world's actually kind of an okay place to be for once. I was back from grad school at the time visiting my family, and this day found my dad and I driving to the north side of Detroit to go to my grandmother's house, who had just passed away. We were going to do work because he was renting the house out to somebody. The catch, though, on this trip was that this trip wasn't just about work. This trip was the chance for my dad and I to talk about what had become the most recent revelation in our family, which was an affair. What I would come to learn at the age of about 23, 24, that this was actually his sixth affair. So we went and we worked through the day and we talked off and on. And we went to a Polish bakery afterwards to get some bread. My grandmother immigrated from Poland, so I have a rich source of cultural appreciation for the carbohydrates that my people create. So sitting in the parking lot, though, I'll never forget this conversation. I told my dad, you cannot keep your family together, your marriage together, and this other woman. Those three aren't going to coexist. You either have to do something to distance yourself from this relationship, or you're going to make choices that are going to sacrifice your family. He looked at me and said, you're an adult now, Ryan. We're going to agree to disagree. I didn't know what to do with that statement. I didn't know how to supply meaning to that statement. And in fact, that statement would create a nearly 15-year search for me for meaning. What did he mean by that? Can I actually agree to disagree on this point? What had he taught me that I still believed? What did I need to now throw away? The story I had been taught about who he was no longer reality. That story I told myself about myself, it now had to change. I had to reimagine his story and my family's story in light of what he had just told me. Stories are how we supply meaning to our experience, but I don't believe that there's just one story storying its way through your life. I think we're a collection of a multiplicity of stories. I think on some fundamental level, if you think about your own life, you probably all can understand the ways in which you would identify with different things and different stories that you attach to. And by using the term story, I mean that a story is the way in which you and I construct reality about who we are, how we fit into this chaotic world. Our story is, in some sense, our identity. The stories we tell is our attempt to organize and systematize this chaos. I think Walter Lippmann in his 1922 work, Public Opinion, was driving at exactly this point when he said, if someone digs up yellow dirt that looks like gold, he will for a time act exactly as if he had found gold. The way in which the world is imagined determines at any particular moment what men will do. It doesn't determine what they will achieve. It determines their effort, their feelings, their hopes, not their accomplishments and results. So the question then is how to find better stories. Are the stories you hold to now true? Are they the best expression of reality? How do we understand reality in a more authentic way that embraces both my experience and the experiences of others? Ultimately, we are seeking to understand who we truly are. American Monk, because I know y'all follow a lot of American Monks, a very educated crowd. Thomas Merton, he said it this way, and I like this. For me to be a saint means to be myself. Therefore, the problem of sanctity and salvation is in fact the problem of finding out who I am and of discovering my true self. I think this is one of our most important struggles as people, discovering who we truly are and living that within society. So what story do you tell yourself? What stories have you bought into that you're completely unaware of and you think it's just the way it is? If we fail to deconstruct and analyze these cultural stories or buy into lesser or false stories, we become trapped in a vocabulary, trapped in a worldview that we cannot escape from. As the character on the TV show said at the beginning, the real danger is if we hear enough lies, enough false stories, we no longer recognize the truth at all. So my hope in the remaining time that we have is to tell you some of my story and give you some language that I hope allows you to see yourself more accurately and tell your story more fully. Because the story you tell yourself about yourself is the most important story you tell. As I said, we're a collection of stories. Many of these stories that make up the complexity of who I am today are stories that were given to me. See, stories didn't start in the great year of 1980 when I arrived on this planet. Stories have been constructed for hundreds and thousands of years before I even got here. Before I took my first breath, there were a multitude of pre-fitted stories that were already ready, waiting for me as soon as I came out in the hospital. These pre-fitted stories are what I call hegemonic narratives. And that's just a fancy, expensive doctoral way, because I'm paying for it right now, of saying a dominant story is something that instructs us on how we should think, act, and live. This city that we're currently in, Dallas, Texas, is built on a host of hegemonic stories. Ashley referenced one in her talk. I'm going to talk about one, and Elijah will talk about a third as well. In WTD fashion, though, I want to unpack what I fundamentally believe to be a hegemonic story that we in America have repeatedly bought into, one that I was taught growing up and one that fundamentally shapes me in ways that I keep investigating. This is the story of whiteness. The reason this story is important is because people who look like me have historically created the institutions through which you and I experience reality. These experiences happen when you interact with, say, a business, when you pay your taxes, when you go to the doctor's office, when you go to church. To live in America is to live in a society constructed through a narrative that I'm going to call whiteness. And this does not mean that only white people experience whiteness, nor that all white people experience it the same, because we don't. Whiteness can be attained through assimilation by minority groups. Because these are socially constructed ideologies, anybody, regardless of skin color, can buy into them. However, any minority group will only be able to go as far as the ones who control the system allow them to get. So I want to make sure before we dive in a little bit deeper that we have some common vocabulary, because words matter, on this discussion. So here we go. This is going to be a little bit dense, but I think y'all can keep up with this. This is stuff that we should talk about more. Prejudice. Prejudice is learned judgment based on stereotypes about a social group that someone belongs to. Prejudice occurs at the individual level. Everybody has it. Right? Yeah. Discrimination are actions based on prejudice. Power, and this is a key component that you've heard Ashley, Elijah, and I talk about. Power is access to and controls of institutions of normalization within our society. Things like legislation, policing, healthcare, business, finance, education. I can go on and on and on, right? The big institutions that normalize the way we understand reality. These arenas help create, drive, and perpetuate that big fancy word, hegemonic narratives, dominant stories. So then if you accept those definitions, then we talk about racism. Racism then is a form of oppression in which one socially constructed group dominates others. It can be simplified to be prejudice plus power equals racism. If you're tracking with me so far and you accept what I've said, then we can formally dispense with the concept of reverse racism. There can be no way in which Ashley and Elijah can institutionally and systemically shut me or the group of people that I represent out of society. On the flip side, because people that look like me created the institutions through which we experience reality, I can both discriminate against Ashley on a one-to-one level and systemically against the people group from which she comes. Does that make sense? Okay. White supremacy, then, is when racism, power, and prejudice put together, is institutionalized into a social hierarchy. We call this hierarchy white supremacy. It's going to be kind of a heavy, I should throw a joke in here right now, but I don't have one. So there you go. Okay, so then whiteness, so all of those things now, and whiteness then is a term to capture all the dynamics that go into being defined and or perceived as white, which create and reinforce white people as inherently superior through society's norms, traditions, and institutions. And make no mistake about this, whiteness grants people material, psychological, and economic advantages. So let me tell you a little bit about my story and the way I've come to understand my reality. Oh, there you go. I forgot about that. The universe is made up of stories, not atoms. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of my story. I was born in the great city of Detroit, Michigan, Motown. But I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. As of the 2000 census data, when I left for college, I went out to Savannah, Georgia, the city I grew up in, the racial makeup was 97% white, 0.3% black. My socialized understanding of race was that black people lived in the downtown area, poor white people lived around that area, but not in that area, and the more affluent white people clearly lived further out. Nobody had to formally teach me this. We didn't have to have a class on it. It was just a lived reality that I saw and ingested. It was the narrative into which I was born. The city I grew up in was only about 20 minutes from this guy. This is the KKK's Grand Dragon Master for the state of Michigan, Robert E. Miles. He would hold Klan rallies at his farm and invite the media so he could get free exposure. And the media came, which is a whole different hegemonic narrative that we're not going to talk about today. Because my upbringing taught me color blindness as a methodology, it was simple for me to say, KKK member bad, because he sees color. Ryan is a good person because I don't see color. I'm colorblind. Everyone's equal. It's here that whiteness becomes normative. It's a normative story through which I order the world. But as I looked and experienced the world, it made less and less sense. And when the stories we hold fail to explain our reality, we begin to search for new stories. For me, WTD came out of part of that search, of the old stories failing to explain reality. Ashley and Elijah were by this point months into telling me, we got to record our conversations and put it out publicly. But for all the work I'd done to understand myself, I still had a rudimentary understanding of racism. It was more akin to tolerating or being nice to black people. I was blinded by an invisible system that I now know is whiteness. It kept me publicly silent. It kept me from starting WTD with Ashley and Elijah. But in talking with Ash and E, in watching murder after murder of unarmed minorities at the hands of the state, in seeing my story of whiteness fail to explain reality, it forced me to confront my story. Then in the wake of the Dallas police shooting on July 7th of 2016, I decided I could no longer sit silently. By that October, Ashley, Elijah, and I released our first episode, which is called The Full Disclosure Edition. And if you listen to that and you cannot hear the fear in my voice, it's only because your speakers are distorting what you hear. Or I guess maybe I masked it well enough. But I was horrified. But the WTD podcast became a way that I began to explore new stories. And fortunately for me, I had two of the most gracious, intelligent, humble, smart, and funny friends and co-hosts to walk alongside and explore with. So let's unpack a little bit of whiteness. Whiteness, I believe, is a collection of stories. As Howard Zinn said, you cannot be neutral on a moving train. If the society which we are all collectively a part is based on white supremacy, when racism is institutionalized, then to do nothing is to support the de facto system. So let's dive into these four smaller stories that you see listed. Individualism. As a white person, we see ourselves as individuals. We are apart from a collective. Because this is going to be kind of difficult to stomach, I stuck really cute baby pictures of myself next to this. So that way, if y'all get really fragile and you don't like what you're hearing, just look at the cute baby picture and you're like, ah, it's not so bad. It's a cute picture. So that's me in diapers. I'm not sure what happened from then to now, but another talk. So individualism, we want to be seen as individuals separate from the collective. Robin DiAngelo talks about it in this way. Individualism is a storyline, again, a storyline that creates, communicates, reproduces, and reinforces the concept that each of us is a unique individual and that our group memberships, such as race, class, and gender, are irrelevant to our opportunities. Individualism claims that there are no intrinsic barriers to success or failure. It's strictly based on your own individual character. We know that being seen as, being seen as old is different than being seen as young, being seen as a Christian versus a Muslim, right? These are, in our Western context, socially created institutions, and we understand that there are advantages that come to being young versus being old, or being old versus being young, depending on where you stand. Objectivity. You are a moral and ethically neutral observer, free from bias and able to render fair and impartial judgments. I would like to note that this is the way in which our social justice system that we currently have in America, what we call social justice or justice system, is constructed. That a judge can sit there and have a view from nowhere and render an impartial verdict, which is why when you see the statue, right, Lady Justice is blindfolded, allegedly. That you can be somehow a detached observer of a reality in which you inhabit. I'd like to submit that that is impossible for you to do. There's no such thing as a view from nowhere. Meritocracy is a system in which people are advanced based solely on their talent and moved ahead on the basis of their achievements. We could spend days talking about this topic. That's my dad, by the way. That's my first day of school. I was horrified. I did not want to go to school. That's why we both kind of looked the same. I guess he wasn't happy about it either. Meritocracy, though, is a myth. I can't dive into all the ways it is. Take it on faith at this point. Listen to our podcast. We've talked about it. Colorblindness. This is a really important component In 1963, a gentleman named Dr. Martin Luther King had a speech, I Have a Dream. In it, he said, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. White America, when they hear this, I believe, redefined racism to be individual acts or dislike of people who look and act differently than you. We no longer understood a corporate understanding of racism. It now became individualized. This meant the story that white people told themselves about themselves changed to color blindness, and we subsequently bought into a narrative that we can somehow become post-racial. I want to weave in a little bit of DISD since we're in the great city of Dallas as a way to describe this story of whiteness. These 4 points, individualism, objectivity, meritocracy, and color blindness. So DISD, if you guys don't know, started in 1884. By 1892 was the first Dallas colored high school that opened. The only place that black people were legally allowed to attend school in the city of Dallas. By 1922, that school changed its name to Booker T. Washington. Dallas continues at that point to operate separate schools, separate but equal, right, like the rest of the country does. Jump to 1954, there are 9 white men on the Supreme Court. They decide desegregation is now to be the way we're going to exercise our reality. They overturn the 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson separate but equal case. And a fun side note, there was one justice on there, Justice Hugo Black. He was an ex-KKK member from the state of Alabama. People in Alabama were so upset that Black was made an enemy of the state. Tuscaloosa News wrote, Black's 2 sons were forced to move out of the state as a result of the racial backlash that followed the Brown decision. Black was barred from the 50th Law School reunion in 1959. The Alabama State Senate passed a resolution recommending Black not be buried within state lines. As the fall of 1954 came, Dallas dug its heels in against the perceived federal overreach. The Dallas Times wrote in 1954, quoting the DISD superintendent, Warren Travis White, who has a school named after him in North Dallas, definitely will not end segregation. The opinion of the Supreme Court, announced on May 17th, was one of philosophy and policy, not a directive or a decree directing that segregation be done. And 2, the schools of Texas are operated under laws enacted by the legislature pursuant to the Constitution. In Texas, the Constitution prescribes segregation. He went on to say that local school boards have no option. They have no option except to carry on the legally constituted segregated schools as presently organized. Over the next 7 years, DISD would be repeatedly in U.S. District Court fighting desegregation. By 1961, 7 years after Brown versus Board, DISD is the largest city in the South and the last in Texas to begin desegregation. They begin their stair-step plan in 1967, where they take 18 African-American students and bus them to white-only schools. And notice the direction that desegregation operates in. It's taking black people and putting them in white schools. Because when you take white people and put them in black schools, what happens? White people leave. We go create the suburbs. In 1967, so 6 years after they start desegregating, DISD self-declares we are desegregated. 3 years later, a gentleman named Sam Tasby, who lives by Love Field, files a lawsuit. He says, you are not desegregated, you are still operating a dual school system. How do I know this? Because I have to take my 2 black children miles down the road to a school when there is a perfectly acceptable school blocks from where I live, but it is an all-white school. I can't go there. This gentleman's court case would wind for the next 30 years through the legal system. In 1983, DISD would finally drop its fight against desegregation. 1983. Brown versus Board was in 1954. It would take until 2003 for the justice system to legally declare DISD had met the provisions of Brown versus Board. So if you grew up in this city in the last 50 years, you have been a part of or influenced by a hegemonic narrative that is segregation. Michelle Alexander's work, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness, which is an excellent book, articulates the way in which vocabulary drives our understanding in this way. She said, "What has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow?" Come on. There we go. "What has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than with the language we use to justify it. In the era of color blindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt, so we don't. Instead, what do we now do? We use the vocabulary of difference: criminal, thug, war on drugs, gangster, to convey the difference, but more importantly, those words convey the danger. The difference must be cultivated as dangerous to affect our reality and drive the narrative of whiteness. Paula Rothenberg stated it this way: "The construction of difference is central to racism, sexism, and other forms of oppression. It's the process of assigning value to difference, not whether the difference is real or imagined. That's the key to the process by which the racist aims to intensify or cause the exclusion, the separation by which the victim is placed outside the community or even outside humanity. In this regard, then, whiteness becomes a privilege to something and a privilege from something. It's a privilege to better schools, jobs, healthcare, housing, and it is a privilege from a vocabulary of difference. Whiteness becomes the norm from which all others diverge. White normativity becomes an insulating dynamic meant to protect those under its umbrella from inquiry and juxtapose all others against a backdrop of difference." Zora Hurston wrote, "I feel most colored when I'm thrown against a what?" Whiteness is that background. Whiteness is a collection of narratives, societal privileges that carry economic value. Anti-racism then means that whiteness is something that I have to wrestle with, to deconstruct, and ultimately to divest from in order to build more equitable systems in its place. Anti-racism is to oppose not merely the individual acts of prejudice, but to work to reconstitute the very stories, the very systems that make up our reality. Whiteness is a story that is constructed to be invisible, like the Matrix. But once you see it, you cannot unsee it. And if you see it, what are you willing to sacrifice to disrupt it? Remember, the real danger is that if we hear enough lies, enough false stories, then we no longer recognize the truth at all. And whiteness is a constructed story since day one. The truth is, whiteness is the story of a social construction that sees and affirms my humanity while executing the humanity of my sister Ashley and my brother Elijah. It's a system that justifies putting children in cages on our border. It's a system that justifies putting Japanese Americans into internment camps during World War II. It is a system that allows our current president to tweet, "There's not a racist bone in my body," after telling four congresswomen to go back to where they came from. Yeah. It's a system that constructs value differences for people groups based on how people like me see the world. Yeah. It's a narrative that systemically disadvantages some and advantages others. It's a story I can no longer adhere to, yet it still permeates my world and the world of those around me. My journey going forward means that I can no longer be neutral. I have to take a stand. I have to look at myself and my complicity in a system that has overwhelmingly been constructed to advantage me. I must work to build systems that are equitable and amplify the voices of those marginalized by our dominant social narrative. That's going to be hard work. But I'm reminded of the words from theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, in his book, The Irony of American History. He said, "Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. The National Peace and Justice Center, created by Bryan Stevenson, commonly called the Lynching Memorial, has these words written, and I would like you all to read them with me, and Ashley, if you want to come, and then we're going to have a small song. These words are written on the space, and that is a picture of the Lynching Memorial that he created.
For the hanged and beaten, for the shot, drowned, and burned, for the tortured, tormented, and terrorized, for those abandoned by the rule of law, we will remember. With hope, because hopelessness is the enemy of justice, with courage, because peace requires bravery, with persistence, because justice is a constant struggle, and with faith, because we shall overcome.
We shall overcome. We shall.